From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. There is a lot of anger right now around the Obamacare rollout. Even political allies of the president are calling it a train wreck. And then there's the president's quote-unquote lie. This woman is one of 73,000 people in Maryland who is losing her insurance.
It's very frustrating, but it's more scary because I'm thinking I'm not covered. So if something should happen, I don't know what I do.
But after the rollout storm has passed, Obamacare will still be there, and so will the big questions. Will the Affordable Care Act actually bring down health care costs, cover more Americans, and make this country healthier? This hour on Point, Obamacare now, and especially tomorrow. You can join us on air or online. Has the messy rollout affected you? Have you lost coverage? Have you tried to sign up? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining me first from Washington is Sam Baker, healthcare correspondent for the National Journal. Sam, welcome to On Point.
Thanks for having me.
So 5 weeks into the rollout of healthcare.gov, Secretary Sebelius was in the hot seat again yesterday before a congressional committee. Give us an update. What happened?
I think at this point we sort of are where we are, which is the website is still broken. That is still a real substantive problem for the Affordable Care Act. It's not just a website problem. It's an enrollment problem. And she has said that they will have it fixed, up and running, by the end of November, which most experts will tell you if they can actually meet that deadline, things will probably be okay on sort of the substantive policy side.
So there were also bipartisan calls to delay parts of the health care law. Lawmakers also suggested extending the open enrollment period or delaying, you know, the financial penalties for those who don't enroll. What was the secretary's response to all that?
She shut all of that down, and I think the consensus is, and you saw her reflect this, is that we're not at that point yet. Some of those delays would have pretty serious consequences, some of which, you know, we haven't even fully fleshed out yet. So their focus right now is just get the website up. If we can meet this new deadline, then there's probably no need to extend the enrollment window or delay the mandate or anything like that.
What about the numbers, Sam? So much has been made about when the Department of Health and Human Services is going to actually release enrollment numbers. What did the secretary say about that?
She said that we would have numbers next week, but one thing that it's really important to keep in mind is these initial numbers really aren't going to tell us much.
Okay. Here's actually some sound. Let's get this in here. This is Utah Senator Orrin Hatch yesterday at the Senate Finance Committee hearings. He's asking for the number of early signups for insurance, how low they will be.
The enrollment numbers, which we will release next week, which will be the first month of enrollment, right, are likely to be quite low, given the struggles that people have had getting access to the site and getting information.
So, Sam, any thoughts about what those numbers will reveal? We hear that they will be low. What's in the numbers?
They will be low. First of all, they'll be low because it's the first month of enrollment, and we always expected low enrollment in the first month. Second, they'll be low because the website is the main way to sign up, and it doesn't work, so people can't sign up. But another thing to keep in mind is that what's important here is not just the total number of people sign up, but the state-by-state breakdown of where people are signing up and who they are. Are they healthy? Are they sick? Are they smokers? Are they not? All of those things will have arguably a bigger impact on premiums next year than just the total number. We don't even know if we're going to get that information next week. Even if we do, again, it's so early, it's going to be really hard to read much into what we do get.
What about the numbers, Sam? CBS News reporting 3.5 million Americans are getting termination notices for their health insurance plans. That's after President Obama famously promised that if you like your health care coverage, you can keep it under Obamacare. Here are the words that got him into so much trouble. This is from a speech he gave in June 2009 to the American Medical Association.
If you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan, period. No one will take it away, no matter what.
So how is this, the White House responding to all this and explaining this, the fact that these people are getting cut from their policies?
They are trying to frame it as an upgrade, saying people aren't getting canceled, people are getting a better deal. They're right to a point. A lot of policies that were available to individuals before, these are people who don't get coverage through their employer like most of us do. A lot of those policies didn't offer good coverage. They came with really high deductibles or just simply didn't cover a lot of important services, but not all of them. So there are people who are getting a better deal. There are also people who just sort of as a byproduct of the way the system works, maybe really did like their plan, had a pretty decent plan, and will have to pay more for something comparable.
What is the total number or the percentage of the total number of Americans that this is affecting? What would they say is the number of people that are actually getting cut? What percentage?
Pretty low. You've somewhere around 5%, I think, is the sort of the number. But it's very difficult to know because, again, everyone who gets a cancellation notice won't necessarily be a quote-unquote loser in this scenario. Some people will get tax credits to help them buy a better plan or will get a better plan in the first place. And then some people will just lose out. So we really don't know yet exactly how all of that will shake out.
So what are some of the other challenges since the rollout that the White House is tackling right now?
Oh, I would say the biggest political challenge for them, I think, is that the two of these things are coming at once, these cancellation notices and the website failure. You know, we all knew that the cancellations were going to happen. This is a story now because they are actually happening, but this was foreseeable. And when you look at it and say, well, why didn't the White House see this coming? Why did they seem so flat-footed by it? The answer sort of almost has to be that they were expecting to have a counterweight of positive stories of all kinds of people who couldn't get coverage before, couldn't afford coverage before, being able to sign up for the first time. And because the website's not working, those stories just aren't there. And even if a couple of people do get through, you know, that's not really the story.
So again, is there a timetable for the website to get up and running? Are there estimates?
The timetable right now is the end of November. Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius has said several times that they think that they can have everything ready by the end of November. Of course, they also said that they were going to have everything ready on October 1st. So this is sort of a fingers crossed kind of situation. They have a punch list of a couple of hundred fixes they say need to be made to the website. They're sort of working through that. There's problems on the front end, problems on the back end. And another thing to keep in mind is that as they fix one problem, they will discover new problems. So this punch list apparently isn't even getting shorter as they work their way through the site, because once one thing comes off, something else comes on.
Are the state exchanges functioning any better?
Some of them are. Some of them are functioning really well. Kentucky has gotten a lot of praise for its exchange. New York is functioning pretty well. California and Washington State are functioning pretty well. There were sort of a series of decisions that went into some of those state exchanges functioning a little bit better. Some of them have had a hard time getting off the ground. Oregon is still having a lot of difficulty. Maryland was a state that a lot of people were really surprised, because Maryland embraced the Affordable Care Act wholeheartedly, was really a leader in getting its exchange set up. They were just at the front of the pack all the way through, and then really stumbled coming out of the gate. But it seems like they're starting to do a little better.
Are there any plans, Sam, to educate the public more about this rollout? What about a PR plan in the middle of all this?
There are. That's a really good question. Some of those plans have been put on hold. Secretary Sebelius mentioned this yesterday. There has been a pretty significant PR blitz planned for this law, which is controversial with Republicans, but is something that was done for Medicare Part D, and it's you know, routine when the government launches something new. A couple of $1 million had been put into that, but all that's on hold now because if you're the administration, there's really not a lot to be gained from spending a lot of money to send people to a website that doesn't work. So they're planning to ramp that up in full once things are back on track.
As you well know, the rhetoric flying around this has been red hot. I'm curious, from your perspective, how would you describe it from both sides, and how is that all impacting the debate in Washington?
It is red hot, but this current sort of round of Obamacare fighting feels a little bit different. And I think the main sign of that is that Democrats are very clearly very worried. Mm-hmm. You know, this isn't just the same kind of Republicans say their thing, Democrats say their thing, and the public approval of the law stays fixed and we move on. That's kind of the cycle that we've gotten used to. There was a meeting at the White House yesterday with President Obama and Vice President Biden personally talking to, I think, 16 Democrats in the Senate, including a lot of people who are facing tough reelection campaigns next year. There's a real fear that this is not that popular in the first place. Democrats have always said, we don't care, it'll work and then it'll be fine. But obviously that depends on it working. And the fact that it's not is changing things.
During yesterday's Senate Finance Committee hearing, Utah Senator Orrin Hatch said the current rollout debacle suggests there are a lot more problems to come with Obamacare, and he asked for regular progress reports from Secretary Sebelius.
I think it's only proper that you provide this committee with more regular updates on the issues with which you are dealing. In fact, I would ask that you come here once a month for the next 6 months to provide this committee with status updates on the implementation of Obamacare.
So we're going to be seeing Secretary Sebelius back in the hot seat, I guess, in the weeks and months to come. This is not over, obviously.
No, it's not. I don't know if they'll successfully get her to testify once a month. But, you know, Congress has done some pretty aggressive oversight, and some of it's been pretty substantive, too, of the implementation effort so far. There were a lot of hearings right before October 1st where pretty senior officials testified before House and Senate committees and said, we're ready to go. This is going to work. Obviously, it didn't. There's a lot to answer for there.
Sam Baker is healthcare correspondent for the National Journal. He joined us from Washington today. Sam, thank you very much.
Thank you.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. Most of the country and all of Washington is talking about Obamacare, and so are we this hour. Here's some sound on October 1st. Comedian and late night show talk show host Jimmy Kimmel took a camera out to Hollywood Boulevard and asked people which they prefer, Obamacare or the Affordable Care Act.
Do you think Obamacare is socialist?
Yes, I do.
Do you think the Affordable Care Act is socialist?
No.
Do you believe that Obamacare will eventually lead to gun prohibition?
Yes.
Do you know that Obamacare and the Affordable Care Act are the same thing?
No, they're not. Thanks, you made me look stupid.
So I'd like now to introduce two very smart and experienced voices on healthcare, one Republican, one Democrat. Both are very involved, have been over the years, in the American healthcare policy and debate. From New York, I'm joined by Gail Walensky. She is former head of Medicare, Medicaid in the elder President Bush's administration and his senior advisor on health and welfare. She was also a healthcare policy advisor to John McCain's 2008 presidential campaign and currently is senior fellow at the International Health Charity Project, HOPE. You can bet she's been watching Obamacare very closely. Gail, welcome back to On Point.
Thank you. And yes, I have been.
Yes. And in the studio with me here in Boston is Jonathan Gruber. He was a key architect of the Massachusetts health reform effort, a.k.a. RomneyCare. He was a consultant to the Obama administration when it was drafting the Affordable Care Act. He advised the Clinton, Edwards, and Obama presidential campaigns in 2008. And when President Obama came to Boston last week to promote the ACA, Jonathan was right there, met with the president. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks. Good to be here.
So what was the president's tone last week when you were with him? What was his demeanor? What did he say to you about all this?
The president is always so relaxed. It was just a quick meet and greet with my wife and myself. But he said he was frustrated by the rollout, but very optimistic that we just need to get over this hump and get things working.
So did you anticipate, Jonathan Gruber, so many problems with this rollout?
I anticipated it would go slowly. I didn't anticipate the technical problems. I'm not an IT guy. It's hard to say what was behind them. But I think based on Massachusetts experience, we anticipated it would go slowly. In Massachusetts, in the first month that individuals could pay and sign up for the plan, 123 people did. By the end of the year, it was 37,000. It takes a while for these things to get rolling. What really matters is the individual mandate coming up in March. That is really what's going to encourage people, especially young and healthy people, to get signed up.
And we'll get to that. Gail Walensky, jump in here. You worked on the Republican side of this huge divide. Did you expect the healthcare rollout to be this dysfunctional, shall we say?
I started hearing that there might be problems with the exchanges early in the summer. But I am very surprised at the depth of the problems. I would not have expected a completely dysfunctional exchange. I'm astounded at some of the decisions that were made that helped bring this about, like having people in CMS serve as basically the coordinator of all the different vendors doing IT work on this exchange. There's no experience typically in what is a very good agency with lots of smart people, but no serious operations experience of that nature. And the decision early on to have people have to enroll before they could go and anonymously shop the way you can typically, either in Medicare.gov or in commercial sites, although there are ways now to get around it. Not so easy. I keep trying to go on and explore some. So I am surprised, given the importance of this first involvement with the American public, with a plan that, as you had indicated and as Sam Baker talked about earlier, has not really been embraced by the American public. More people dislike it than like it. That's been true since it was passed. I would have thought the administration would have done whatever it took to guarantee this was a smooth rollout.
Let's talk about the president's so-called credibility problem in the last couple of weeks on this issue of millions of Americans who've had their personal coverage canceled. The president said from the beginning, if you like your health care plan, you can keep your health care plan. I was reading in the Wall Street Journal, Obama's advisors knew the president was making a promise he couldn't keep. Jonathan Gruber, based on your understanding of the law, is that true?
The main point of President Obama's statement was that for the vast, vast majority of Americans, this law will not affect you. That's the main point he was trying to get across. He probably should have said something like, for almost all Americans, you won't have to change your plan. I think in the annals of political overstatements, this is a pretty minor one. But the important point is that for the vast majority of Americans, those who have employer insurance or insurance from the government, this law doesn't really affect them. It's the minority of Americans who buy insurance on their own, the currently about 4% of Americans who buy insurance in the individual market, who'll be affected. About half of them have plans that are already generous enough that they meet the standards of Obamacare. They might have to switch plans because there's some minor tweaks here and there. But by and large, they're going to be okay.
It's the expectation, I think. They were told one thing, right, and then something else happens.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think what the message President Obama was trying to deliver is that this is not a socialist takeover of the economy. This is not ripping up our entire healthcare system and starting over. I think the Obama administration learned from previous health reform efforts that the way to make this succeed was to by and large leave people alone with what they liked. I think as Sam Baker said, the hope now was that by now there'd be so many more winners than losers that the losers would be drowned out by the winners. But the website slowdown has made that hard.
Gail Wilensky, this particular problem, supporters of Obamacare say it's a feature, not a bug of the Affordable Care Act. What say you?
Well, as somebody who worked in the George Herbert Walker Bush administration, I'm particularly sensitive to the difficulty that presidents can get themselves in when they make a blanket statement that turns out, for whatever reason, is not the case. In this case, it was, read my lips, no new taxes. That didn't work very well. Some of the statements of President Clinton came back to haunt him. When you say something as simple and declarative as, if you like your health care plan, you'll be able to keep your health care plan, period. No one will take it away no matter what. That's the kind of absolute statement that gets people very frustrated and very angry, because the fact is, it's not true. As Jonathan said, for many people, they won't either know or notice that they've had a change in plans as a result of the Affordable Care Act, or for some people who have individual insurance that's been limited or expensive, they may prefer what they have. But as we're hearing, there are people who were happy enough with their plans. If they don't get a lot of subsidy, what they are now going to be able to buy may be more expensive.
Yep.
And just as a matter of course, many Americans don't like to have the government saying, you must buy this, and if you don't, we're going to fine you.
Here's a listener who falls into that category. I think Phil is calling from Hebron, Illinois. Phil, welcome to On Point. Hello.
I'd just like to make a real quick statement for you.
Okay.
I've been a small businessman, entrepreneur for 24 years, always paid for my own insurance and for my employees. I got my letter 5 weeks ago, made a call to the president, made a call to Dick Durbin, number two of the Senate, my senator, and Mr. Obama was my senator before he was your president. I haven't received any information back. I don't have the time for the website right now. I run my own business. And I'd like to put it in the context that I was able to speak to Mr. Paul Krugman, Pulitzer, Nobel Prize winner in economics that leans Democratic, and he said there's one group of people that since all the stimulus spending, and say the government hasn't raised their finger one bit to help, It's the small businessman. I went through a complete audit from the IRS.
Mm-hmm.
Auditor said to me at the end of 6 hours, you consider yourself an entrepreneur. Everything is at risk. And I said, yes, I do. And he said to me, the government doesn't believe you exist, my young friend.
Phil, thank you. Jonathan Gruber, speak to people like Phil. And we heard it from Sam Baker earlier. You know, I think Democrats in Washington feel this is a very different situation right now that they find themselves in with. People like Phil, you know, quite upset.
Look, I think there's two issues. One is Phil is reflecting a larger set of uncertainties about our economy that Krugman writes about all the time and that affect small businesses and really many, many Americans. I think we need to focus instead on, in this conversation, on the set of issues around the law per se. And for many small businesses, there will be a whole bunch of new options that will be available once the website gets up and going. I think it comes once back into what Sam Baker said. Small businesses next year, for example, for the first time, will be able to let their employees shop across a wide variety of health insurance options. There'll be a tax credit available for small and low-wage businesses. But in the meantime, while the website's not working, I understand the uncertainty people face. I understand the uncertainty Phil feels. But he has to. I hope he can recognize that actually at the end of the day, he'll end up with more options and hopefully more affordable options than he has today.
Sam Baker talked about a timetable that's been spun around in Washington. The end of November, this website needs to get up and running. Jonathan, talk about that. I mean, Secretary Sebelius promised that the exchanges would be fully functioning by then, by the end of November, November 30th, I think she said. Play this out for us. What if the site is not fully operational by the end of November? Then what?
Yeah, I mean, I've been likening it to sort of military parallel. Currently, we're in sort of DEFCON 4, which is sort of political problem. If it's not working by the end of November, we sort of move to DEFCON 3, which is substantive problem. But I think the real deadline is if it's not working by March, we enter DEFCON 2, which is crisis. And the reason I focus on that date is that's the date on which people have to buy insurance for the individual mandate. Remember, let's talk about what working
means. Which means that President Obama would have to delay the individual mandate at that point?
I think there could be a substantive – I think he may have to delay it if the website's not working well by then. But let's just talk for 1 minute about what working means. Let's separate shopping from enrollment. The website has to work for shopping. People can't shop for these products on paper over the phone. It's too complicated. It doesn't have to work for enrollment. There's no reason people can't enroll on paper over the phone. So the main goal is to have a functional shopping experience working, hopefully by then November, and critically by early next year. And then if people have to enroll over the phone, I think that's going to be okay.
Gail Wilensky, do you see a difference between shopping and enrollment at this point?
Well, I have some differences on the timetable you just heard. In the first place, I don't know whether Secretary Sebelius is citing the end of November based on information that the technical people who are in charge of the fixes have provided with some assurance, or this is a politically chosen date. I don't know, but I wouldn't die of shock if it's the latter, a politically chosen date. Right now, the administration needs to be very careful not to make promises it may not be able to keep. And I would just urge them to be very cautious about making absolute statements or very strong statements that are may not work. The second thing is that you need to give people some time. So while technically it is correct that you have until the March 31st before you would be penalized for not having insurance, if it's not easy to know what your options are and to enroll by mid-February, it is going to be very difficult to hold people accountable for not having insurance if they haven't had a reasonable amount of time to both look and enroll. And for people who are at risk of losing their insurance at the end of December, you really need to find a way to make sure they're okay by early December, or they will be at risk for being without insurance.
Well, that's exactly right, because January 1st, those people whose coverage has already been dropped, they're going to be in big trouble, Jonathan.
That's exactly right. That's why it becomes a big problem if this isn't working by that point. We need to have a mechanism for those people to enroll. If not, there needs to be some other approach to helping those people have a transition coverage until the website is working. So I think we do have to worry about that population. And if the website isn't working in time for them to enroll in January, there'll have to be some transition plan put in place to help them out.
And what do you foresee that being?
The transition plan could be, for example, a requirement on insurers that those individuals who have policies they're going to cancel at the end of the year, they'd be required to keep them on those plans for another couple months until the website's working. I think that they're already talking about that in some states, and I believe that it's not a great outcome. It would be much better if the website was working, but that may be the kind of outcome that works, that holds till, as Gail said, till mid-February. I agree with her. People need time, but I think the important point to recognize is that the real deadline is March 31st, and we saw in Massachusetts Massachusetts that the bulk of enrollment really happened at the very last minute. So I think when we come back to this notion of Secretary Sebelius giving monthly enrollment numbers, remember October, November aren't really what matters. What matters is making sure we have everyone in by March.
Let's get some sound in here. That conversation that's been going on nationally in the media and other places this week, the last few weeks. Here's Fox Business News anchor Stuart Varney last week making no bones about what he personally hopes for the Affordable Care Act.
I want Obamacare to be repealed. I want it defunded. I want it to go down in history as a disgraceful attempt to socialize our health care system. Yes, I want it to fail. Government does not do things well. And this is a government takeover.
Well, Fox News goes great guns attacking Obamacare. MSNBC has been fighting back. Here is Chris Matthews on Hardball attacking Republicans.
The GOP has been blinded by an obsession to destroy the president's health care law. And when it comes to an alternative, they have none. Despite its rollout problems, it's my view that the president and the Democrats at least want to help Americans get health care. Republicans aren't even trying or even saying they're trying.
Gail Wilensky, Jonathan Gruber, I'll ask you what I asked Sam Baker. How is the rhetoric that's flying around this issue, how is it affecting the debate? How is it impacting the implementation of what we're seeing now? Gail, you first.
It's really unfortunate. There are some things that the Affordable Care Act does that are very important. May not do them as well as it could have been done, but it is due to expand coverage to a large number of the people who have previously been uninsured. That's important. That's a good thing. There have been some alternatives, serious alternatives, that Republicans have proposed over the years, like Senator McCain when he was running, or Senators Coburn and Burr and Paul Ryan in the House. But in general, the Republicans have had far less attention. To some extent, they had 2 decades to try to get this done. They didn't. We shouldn't be surprised that Democrats have made this a very big issue. A repeal without being very clear what you're replacing with is not good for the American public. We've got to do something with 15% of the population who are uninsured, and we need to bring health care spending on a sustainable way, growing at a slower rate.
Jonathan?
Yeah, the Republican criticisms of both the law and the rollout sort of remind me of the old joke that Paul Krugman cited the other day about the woman who goes for dinner and says, boy, the food's terrible and the portions are too small. It's sort of they kind of are criticizing both the law substance and how it's rolling out. I think the important point coming – Gail made a great point, but actually I'd give Republicans more credit than Gail gives them, because really the core of Obamacare came from people like Gail and people who were thinking innovatively on the Republican side in the early 1990s about health care reform. They came up with the idea of the individual mandate. The Heritage Foundation and other conservative organizations decided this was a better alternative to what President Clinton was proposing in the early 1990s. And that's why Governor Romney adopted it here in Massachusetts. Indeed, at the signing of the bill, there was a speaker from the Heritage Foundation to talk about what a great law this was in Massachusetts. It was only once President Obama put his name to it that it became the devil's work.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the future of health care in this country and whether Obamacare will work as planned. Or are we looking at a mess in the years to come? Great guests this hour, Gail Wilensky and Jonathan Gruber. Gail worked for years with Republican administrations to redesign American healthcare coverage. Jonathan was a key participant in the design of Obamacare and also worked on Mitt Romney's healthcare overhaul in Massachusetts. Gail, putting aside the botched rollout, the Affordable Care Act is, to your mind, as I understand it, just a bad piece of legislation. What are the biggest flaws in all this?
There are two areas. One, we'll come back to this maybe later. It is only beginning to touch the reform of the delivery system. But let me go back to the area that it focuses on, which is expanding coverage. It is critical to get young people to enroll in these exchanges. They're the ones that are going to make for the affordable part of Affordable Care Act, and yet there's some disconnects in the policy. For one thing, the amount that will be charged young people is actuarially unfair. It's too high. It was done to soften the blow for the premiums that would otherwise be charged the pre-Medicare population. The second thing is we have guaranteed people that if they do wait, pay the penalty for not having it, they will never be discriminated against in the future. no matter how clear it is that they now need to have care. And the third thing is, early on, the penalties are very low, very small. So you put together the group that has already indicated some reluctance historically to get insurance. You make it actuarially more expensive than it is, in fact, fair for them to bear. You guarantee them they can come in later without any discrimination, and the penalty for not doing it is really, really small. This is not a good way to get the reluctant young immortals, as we call them, into insurance if they're not really inclined to do so.
Jonathan Gruber, to that point, are we disincentivizing these young people to sign up?
I think we do need young people to sign up. I think what Gail is understating a bit is the fact that even with a modest penalty, you can actually see sign up. We saw it in Massachusetts. Our first year penalty was only about $200, and yet we got a large number of young people signing up, only at the last minute, but they did sign up. I think the broader point I recognize is that when you ask Gail or Christians of the law, they're actually on relatively modest points. If you step back and look at the big picture, I'm struck by the agreement between healthcare analysts on the right and the left with this general structure of a way to go forward to reform the coverage part of the U.S. healthcare system, which is private health insurance choice promoted through a government-regulated market. This is an idea on which analysts from both the right and the left agree. As I said, many of the ideas originally came from the right. And I think what's lost in all this noise over particulars is that the fundamental structure here is not, as that Fox commentator said, a socialist takeover of one-sixth of the economy. The fundamental structure is to try to build on what works to fix private insurance choices for individuals who don't get insurance from their employer.
But the fundamental structure depends on young people signing up, right? I mean, I'm reading here, bottom line, 40% of enrollees need to be young, healthy consumers. And I also read that we're not really even close to that.
Well, once again, I think it's way too early to say. As I said, in Massachusetts, if you look at the data, the last ones in were the young, healthy people. So there's no way we can even say whether this is working or not until we get the data through March. That's the first point. The second point is, look, this is a brand new world. It's a new experiment. Gail raises some good issues, but we do have this is probably the most significant piece of social policy in our nation's history where we ran the experiment first. We did it here in Massachusetts with a penalty that was small. We got the young people in. It'll happen nationally, too.
Let's get Francis in here from West Palm Beach, Florida. Hi, Francis. Glad you waited. You're on.
Hi. Thank you. Mm-hmm. I'm a pediatric occupational therapist. I'm single. I'm 53 years old, a 53-year-old American who has had no hope of getting health care because insurance companies won't touch me with a 10-foot pole. But I make enough money that I don't get Medicaid. But what I want to say is that I would ask that other Americans, you know, please be patient and encourage maybe their legislators to pitch in and help Obama to get health care to everybody instead of just those who can afford it or work full time.
Have you signed up, Francis? Have you signed up at healthcare.gov?
Yes. Yeah, I had to work on it several times, but I finally did. This past weekend, I was able to get on before they shut it down for the night to work on it, but I got through the whole thing.
And were you happy with the outcome? Did you like what you ended up with?
Well, unfortunately, in Florida, our governor didn't expand Medicaid, but what happened was it said that because of my situation, they were sending my information to Medicaid to see if I qualified, which I know I won't.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
I'm above that level income-wise, so I need to find out. That's why I'm asking that we continue to work on this so that all these loopholes clean up and there's a way for all of us to get covered, because otherwise nobody would insure me at all.
Francis, thank you so much. Gail Walensky. There's Francis looking at the future, hoping for some optimism here. I must say, I've been reading a lot about the next shoe to drop, so to speak, in this evolving story. Many say will be the disappointment that consumers have once they get on to healthcare.gov. In Francis's case, it was a state issue, but I'm hearing that there will be sticker shock, prices higher than they anticipated, limited choice. Gail, what are you hearing about that and your thoughts associated with that?
I am hearing very similar stories. It is not easy to navigate. I hope that Frances checks to see whether or not she could buy in the exchange. If she's at the poverty line or above, it might not be as good a coverage as Medicaid, but she can get a healthy subsidy and go look at the plans that are available. What I'm hearing from people is frustration that they frequently can't tell what it is they're buying with their money. That is, they may know the deductible and copayments, or they may know how much the exposure they would have financially with the plans they can choose. It's very hard to find out who's in the network. Many of these plans have very restricted networks. That was the only way the companies could meet the exchange allowed premiums that they could negotiate. And being a smart shopper is not only knowing what it costs you, but what you get for your money. That is very difficult. Many people are going to have an unpleasant surprise when they actually go use their plan. I assume for most people, this will get resolved ultimately. I certainly hope so. There can be a real surprise if you thought you had more choice and you find out that you don't. Of course, it depends what you had before. Yep. If you had very little choice before, yep, then it might not be so serious.
Jonathan Gruber, what about these restricted networks that Gail talks about? People actually don't know what they're getting for their money.
I think that's a major advantage of where we're heading once we get the website working. And I urge your listeners, if they're curious, to go look at the website we've had running for 5 years in Massachusetts, an actually award-winning website called mahealthconnector.org, where you can see actually very clearly laid out your choices. The important point to emphasize is today you can't see that. And the mistake I think that's being made in this debate is comparing Obamacare to some world we wish we had. We have to compare Obamacare to the world we have today, which is a world where people like Frances can't get health insurance because they're discriminated against by insurers. If they try to go on and shop, they can't compare their choices because there's no website to go do so. It's a world in which even if insurance is available, it's very skimpy and wouldn't cover major medical needs. That is a world that ends on January 1st. Now, we've got to get the website up and running to make that end, but we have to remember the winners here as well as focusing on the losers. I think this debate is subject a bit to what I call the victory of anecdotes over aggregates. There's a lot of anecdotes of people who are losing their doctor, losing their coverage. We're missing the aggregates, which is the millions of people like Frances who will now be able to get insurance who couldn't before.
Here's Rick in Madison, Wisconsin. Hi, Rick. Welcome to On Point.
Hi, Jane.
Hi.
You know, I'm not really sure why I keep hearing people say that the website is broken. You know, just like Frances, I went on there. I signed up. I didn't have any problem doing it. It was broken for 2 weeks, but then it started working, and I didn't have any problem. I'll tell you one thing. It's a million times easier than filling out an application under the previous law where you had to list every health problem you ever had. I mean, it's a million times easier.
So you had a good experience.
Oh, yeah, and anybody can verify it. All you got to do is go try it. Instead of talking about what other people are saying, go do it. Go try it out. It's easy.
Rick, thank you.
It worked for me, and I just want to say
that
when I got done, I got 44 options, okay? And the most expensive plan was $1,500 with a zero deductible, zero co-insurance, basically zero out-of-pocket. And before this, the only plan I could find was $2,400 for my family, and that had a 20% coinsurance and $4,000 deductible.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, and so I'm saving $900 a month for my family. Okay? And we're normal people; we're healthy, but I'm buying on the insurance individual market. You know, I'm 50 years old. I'm like Frances. I don't get a subsidy. Okay, so that part was easier for me. And the other thing is that, like Gail was saying, it's an HMO model now, so you got to stay in a network. But
so it sounds like you're a happy customer, Rick. I'm glad to hear it. Gail Walensky, there's Rick. He's had 44 healthcare options. He's a happy customer. I guess many others hope to be like him.
Well, that's terrific that he had a good experience. It is clear the federal exchange is struggling to handle very many people. And the state's experience varies dramatically in terms of how people have fared. The hope is that ultimately, when this is running well for most people, they will find it a good experience. E-insurance has worked well for a lot of people, but not for everybody. And the problems of having pre-existing conditions in the insurance, private insurance market has been a problem. Many of these issues were solved in 1996 with legislation for those of us who were fortunate enough to be part of group insurance. But this other market has been a very troubled market for many people. But as we're hearing now, some people liked what they had. If they hadn't been told they can keep it if they like it, we probably would not get this huge pushback from them. We'd still get a pushback from people who are frustrated. They are still having trouble getting on the website.
Let's pull back a little bit and look ahead and assume that the rollout eventually gets sorted out, the computer glitches are fixed. Will we have good health insurance, a good health insurance plan in place in this country? What do you foresee 1, 2, 5 years down the road, Jonathan Gruber?
So I think as Gail started to talk about, we have to separate coverage and cost control. In terms of coverage, I'm fully confident that 1, 2, 3 years down the road, we're going to have a system that works very well. The vast majority of Americans will be covered, will increase insurance coverage substantially, and people will like it. And I think we can base that both on projections from nonpartisan sources and our own experience here in Massachusetts. So I think once we get this rolling, if the political system allows it to roll forward and we get more people like James who can actually experience it, we'll actually see success and popularity, just like the 2/3 popularity the law has in Massachusetts. One last fact, remember, before Medicare Part D rolled out, it was actually less popular than the Affordable Care Act. It only had 31% public approval. Now it's like 90%. We just have to get this in place.
Under George Bush the second.
Mm-hmm. Now, but Gail raised another issue, which is once we get coverage in place, we then need to move on to cost control. Cost control is much, much harder.
Which we've struggled with here in Massachusetts.
We've struggled with here in Massachusetts. And I think the idea that this law is a failure because it doesn't control costs is simply wrong. Politically and scientifically, we don't know how to yet. Whenever the law tried, it got accused of setting up death panels or other things which were easy to attack. So I think cost control is the next step. I think we need to take it. This law moves forward in certain ways on cost control through features like the Cadillac tax and through facilitating experiments and setting up new health insurance arrangements like accountable care organizations. It doesn't go far enough. We need to go farther, but we need to take these initial steps. We need to get everyone covered and then move forward on some of the initiatives that are in this law on cost control.
Gail Walensky, what about cost controls in the years ahead? Does that worry you?
Oh, it does worry me. Jonathan and I agree very much on this issue. What the Affordable Care Act concentrates on is expanding coverage to a large number of Americans. I assume the problems that need to be fixed there, maybe some exchange rules that are too controlling, will get fixed over time. By and large, that problem is mostly addressed. The future one we have to deal with is how to improve quality, how to have sustainable spending in the long term for private insurance, and even more importantly, for Medicare and Medicaid, our entitlement programs. We are taking some initial baby steps. We'll have to see whether we can drive the successful innovations to be part of our healthcare delivery system. It's not comprehensive reform that we've passed, but it is a good first step to expanding coverage. That was important. It's got some problems we have to fix. We'll need to fix them. We just can't fool ourselves that this was comprehensive healthcare reform, as some of the more extravagant supporters sometimes call it.
You know, it strikes me as you both have been talking this hour that you have been working on this issue, this healthcare dilemma in this country for years, often together at the same table, Gail and Jonathan. You understand this better than anybody else, the process of it, the insides of it, the content, what we're dealing with. What have you learned along the way? Jonathan Gruber, you first. What have you learned?
I think I've learned along the way that there are very tough political constraints that academics don't typically appreciate and that we need to recognize in dealing with this. We need, for example, to recognize that single-payer health care is off the table politically. We need to recognize that doing fundamental cost controls at this date is hard because of the political opposition. And what I really like about this reform, and really was pioneered by Governor Romney here in Massachusetts, is it is that elusive sort of third way. It's really a bipartisan approach to try to deal with a problem we could deal with. Someone once described this to me after the ACA as the most partisan bipartisan law in history, that it really is a bipartisan approach that people like Gail and I can by and large agree on the structures of to try to achieve the answer we could achieve, to not let healthcare reform as it has every 20 years for the last century founder on the shores of trying to achieve too much. And I think that's something that's hard to appreciate.
Gail Walensky, what have you learned?
I think we've learned that incentives are really important. On the big structures, those of us who have worked in this area have large-scale agreement. We are recognizing that encouraging and rewarding the kind of behavior we want to see from physicians, from hospitals, occasionally even including the patient in this mix, making sure that coverage is available to people who have been shut out either because they couldn't afford it or because they had pre-existing conditions is important as part of the move ahead. These are very political and partisan issues, and I very much agree with the assessment that whether or not people think they would like to go to a single-payer system, it's not an efficiency question. It's a value, political value question. In the U.S., we have chosen a different way. I want to see this fixed so it can work.
Gail Walensky joining us from New York, former head of Medicare, Medicaid, among other things. Gail, thanks so much for your time today.
Thank you for having me.
Jonathan Gruber here in the studio, key architect of the Massachusetts Health Reform, consultant to many a president on healthcare issues. Jonathan, thank you so much.
Good to be here, Jane.
We'll call on both of you again as this continues. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.